Today's guest asserts that there are fundamentally two ways you can experience the police in America. One is that they are the people you call when there's a problem, or they are the people behind the ominous knock on the door. Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk, and I am very pleased to introduce to you today's guest, Dr. Angela J. Hattery. Dr. Hattery is an expert in several areas related to race, gender, violence, and the criminal justice system. Dr. Hattery is professor and director of Women and Gender Studies at George Mason University in Virginia. She's very busy. She is the author of several books, including Intimate Partner Violence. And today, we discuss the book and the work co-created with her colleague, Dr. Earl Smith. It is entitled Policing Black Bodies, How Black Lives Are Surveilled, and How to Work for Change. Dr. Hattery, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you for having me.
You and your colleagues say very early on in Policing Black Bodies that it was a book that was difficult to write, perhaps the most difficult book you had ever written. Why is that?
The book was very difficult to write, I think, because the material is so hard to hold. As we're writing the book and watching the news, you know, the people keep more and more black bodies are policed by the are policed as we're writing the book. And so holding on to all of the stories of the people that we included in the book, but also the people that we didn't include in the book, takes a lot of emotional energy. We were writing the book during the summer of 2016, and July of that summer, I believe there were three or four unarmed black men killed by the police in a single week. And it takes a lot of energy to focus on that and write about it and not turn it off like a lot of other people do.
Well, you know, there are some folks who are listening who are saying, oh, here we go again, another one of those black folks whining about how badly they're treated when we all know that they're the ones who commit most of the crimes. What do you say to that?
Well, I say you should take a look at the data because that's what we analyze. So the book really takes a look at those myths and misperceptions that many people have about why black bodies are policed. You know, the data are pretty clear. Black people commit more of certain kinds of crimes, but white people commit more of certain other kinds of crimes. So when you shake it all out, it's really a myth to believe that the police are racially profiling because black people are committing more crime. We're arguing that the police are racially profiling, and it's not at all related to the amount of crime that's actually taking place in that community.
You talk about going to Money, Mississippi and Sumner, Mississippi. What did these areas have in common?
Both Money, Mississippi and Sumner, Mississippi are important in the history of Emmett Till and the murder of Emmett Till in 1955. So Money, Mississippi is the site of Bryant's store where Emmett Till allegedly wolf whistled or catcalled Mrs. Bryant, which is allegedly the incident that leads to her husband and her husband's half-brother, J.W. Milam, murdering Emmett Till. And Sumner, Mississippi is the site where the two men were tried during a hot week. If you read the history, it's actually pretty fascinating by an all-white, all-male jury, because not only were blacks not allowed to serve on juries, but women weren't either. They were tried that summer and acquitted, and the jury writes that it took less than an hour to acquit them, and it would have taken even less time if they had stopped for lunch.
It's pretty stunning. But yes, it is a part of history that many of us are aware of. You mentioned Emmett Till. Emmett Till, Trayvon Martin, Mike Brown, Philando Castile, Freddie Gray, Charles Kinsey, what do these people all have in common?
What they all have in common is that they're black men, mostly young, but not all, who were killed unnecessarily. They were black men, you know, kind of minding their own business, or maybe a little bit less than minding their own business, but certainly not engaged in crime that would require police to shoot and kill them. And we connect all of them to Emmett Till. because what we see is that Trayvon Martin and Mike Brown and Freddie Gray and all of the people that you mentioned, and there are many, many more, are sort of modern day versions of Emmett Till for two reasons. One, because they're young Black men who were killed for, you know, not really any reason at all. But secondly, because the videos of their murders are sort of similar to Emmett Till's mother, Mamie Till, making the decision to put Emmett Till's picture, the picture of his face, on Jet magazine. That that these cases share in common an opportunity for the visuals to be shared so that people get kind of a shock value about what's actually going on.
Do you think that the shock value remains today? And I ask that because, quite frankly, we hear about so many people, Black people, who are shot and killed. Are we as shocked as we were at one point?
You know, I think that's a really good question. And I think I feel I could sort of go 50-50 on this one. On the one hand, I think there's a saturation effect, right? That we become so accustomed to seeing these images that they don't mean so much anymore. On the other hand, I would argue maybe we need to keep seeing more of them. Not that we need more people to be killed, of course, but, you know, kind of when are we going to say, wow, enough is enough. I can't look at this anymore, and not look at this anymore and shut my Facebook off. But I can't look at this anymore. We need to be moved to action. So I think one of the questions is, how many does it take? How many of these images does it take before we stand up and say, no, that's enough. We can't do that anymore.
You say in Policing Black Bodies, and I quote, "It was and still is difficult to imagine a time when the violence and the policing of Black bodies will stop. We have trouble imagining when it will slow down." That's a really, I mean, we've sort of hinted at it before in this conversation, but that's such a huge, powerful statement and such a, I don't know, almost a mountain of sadness, if you will, of despair, if you really allow yourself to feel what your words say.
And that's when you asked early on in the interview about how difficult the book is to write or was to write. I mean, that's, you're pointing to the exact reason, because you have to hold this and you have to think carefully about the impact of the book, but also, you know, what can I imagine? Can we imagine a time when this will not end? And, you know, it's interesting. The book was published in December of 2017, and things were a little quiet in the winter. And then all of a sudden in March, we had three Black people killed by the police, unarmed, most of us, many of us who are in higher education, were on spring break. And you think, oh, just when it quiets down, it starts up again. And, you know, that's really what the book is about, is, you know, kind of ringing a bell, but also thinking through and talking about what would it take for all of this to stop. And it's clear that it's not just videos and it's not just Facebook. And as important as protests are in the street, it's not just protests in the street. It's going to have to be some pretty radical change in terms of the way that we police Black bodies, but also the way that we value Black bodies.
You know, the other point to be made is that even though there seemed to be a period of time when it quieted down, and I completely agree with you, you know, it felt like, you know, maybe something a little different was happening or not happening. But the truth is I don't know that we know how many Black bodies are destroyed, because they don't come to the fore. You know, they're not on Facebook. They're not in the news. We really, in a lot of ways, have no idea.
You're exactly right. And that's also what we try to do in the book. So when we tackle the discussion of the shooting of unarmed Black men, and that's really the focus of the chapter, but we do also nod to and acknowledge Black women are killed by the police also. Sandra Bland is the name that most people would be familiar with, you know, but we also talk about a woman named Natasha McKenna, who was killed in the Fairfax County Jail. She was tased while in a restraint chair. We spend time and really try to call the names of people that didn't make it into the news, people who just a real blip on the radar screen, because we think it's important. And I agree with you 100%. You know, we were asking ourselves the question when it got quiet for a little while, is it really a pause or is it in fact, these are just cases that didn't rise to the attention of CNN? And I think if you look at some of the cases in March, that's exactly what we found. They were quiet at first. And the shooting in Sacramento got some more attention because people were protesting at the basketball arena, the Sacramento Kings, and some attention there. But otherwise, they fly under the radar screen unless you're looking for them.
You say that the system of chattel slavery, along with the Three-Fifths Compromise, provided the justification for ultimately what is the policing of black bodies, literally and symbolically. What do you mean by that?
What we mean, and actually we get some questions about this when we talk. Often people ask the question, why focus on black people and not on other minorities? Why not focus on Hispanics or Latinos, et cetera? And our answer is not because those bodies aren't being policed, because they are, but because the focus of the book is tracing the history that you just articulated, that the condition of black people in the contemporary United States is one that is rooted in, you know, chattel slavery. And it's I don't think we can say that enough. I think people like to talk about, you know, this kind of slavery or that kind of slavery, or there was slavery in Greece and slavery in Rome and all of that. But none of those forms of slavery, other than the bondage, the chattel version of slavery that held black people in the United States, was inheritable, permanent. You know, the word chattel is like a farm animal, right? Black people were bought and sold. Their status was inherited. You know, every baby born, you couldn't get out of this condition for hundreds of years. You couldn't get out of this condition. It wasn't possible legally. And so that we argue that that sort of that lays the groundwork for the devaluing of black bodies today that allows for the policing, everything from, you know, police shooting innocent, unarmed, young. Let's talk about Tamir Rice. He was 12 years old. Young black bodies, but other kinds of policing as well, like the shackling of black women while they're giving birth, or the experimentation of various birth control devices on young black teenagers, mostly in Baltimore. That none of that is possible, or you can't explain it unless you understand or consider the you know hundreds of year history of chattel slavery and holding black people, you know, the Three-Fifths Compromise is less than fully human.
Given that much of the history of what is recognized as slavery in America dates back many years, is there still a problem? Aren't you just kind of making much ado about nothing?
Yeah, I think that's always the reaction, right? Like, can't we move on? That's ancient history. But it's actually not ancient history. And, you know, it lays the groundwork for what we talk about in the book. And part of the reason it's not ancient history is I try to think about it this way, that we talk in the book about, you know, when one group of people can own things and run businesses and own land and accumulate wealth, all of that stays in that community. When another group of people, in this case Black Americans, aren't able to do any of that, it's like starting a race 300 or 400 years behind. And so that even if we're not continuing to hold Black people as slaves, and we debate that a little bit in terms of incarceration, where it is legal to treat people as slaves, and that's part of the 13th Amendment, several hundreds of years of accumulating advantage in the white community and disadvantage in the Black community, you know, results in enormous gaps, racial gaps in education, in wealth, in all kinds of things that then change people's or limit people's opportunities to be successful or to have their bodies policed.
You make, and as we talk about you and your colleague, again, your colleague is Dr. Earl Smith, who is the co-author of Policing Black Bodies, How Black Lives Are Surveilled, and How to work for change. You make the point, the two of you, that one of the least common crimes, the rape and murder of white men, of white women by black men. And I got to repeat, that is one of the least common crimes, because so many people think that's the most common crime. Again, the least common crime, the rape and murder of white women by black men, is the most common source of wrongful convictions and exonerations. How can that be?
It's stunning, right? And I appreciate that you said it twice, because that's one of those statistics that people, you know, believe, they just hold a falsehood about it. And it's very hard to convince them otherwise. We spend a lot of time on exonerations in the book, and I'm glad you brought it up, because very few people talk about it. And exonerations, you know, it's hard. This is another part that's hard to hold in your head, right? Locking up people for 10, 15, 20, 30, 40, 50 years for a crime that they didn't commit. It's bad enough to go to prison for a crime you did commit. But imagine withholding someone's, not just their liberty, but their human and civil rights, withholding that for decades for a crime that they didn't commit. I was actually stunned, to be honest with you, when we started doing the numbers and running the statistics for that analysis. As you point out, white women who are raped only 10% of the time, 10, 12% of the time, is the perpetrator a black man. But among wrongful convictions, that's around 70% of the cases. So black men are locked up wrongly seven times more often than they actually commit the crime. And we spend a lot of time in that discussion thinking about all the way back in history, the, you know, tens of thousands of black men who were lynched over the false accusation of raping a white woman. And there are many other scholars, Angela Davis among them, who've done a lot of good work documenting that the allegation was almost never true. Tens of thousands of black men were lynched because of that. And we argue that wrongfully convicting black men for the rape and or murder of a white woman is the criminal justice version of a lynching, taking away not literally their life, but all of their civil liberties, human rights. And, you know, we really need to, I think, remember, it's easy to just put those numbers out. Someone's locked up for 10 or 20 or 30 years for a crime they didn't commit. You know, think about what, I encourage your listeners to think about what you've done in the last 20 or 30 years that you wouldn't have been able to do if you were incarcerated. Maybe start a family, maybe go to college, maybe get a job, maybe buy a house, maybe move, maybe get married, maybe do a number of things that these men are deprived of. Those are years that you don't ever get those back. And that's when these men are locked up, usually in their late teens or early 20s, until they're, you know, middle-aged. It's just, I can't say strongly enough how important it is to put attention on that. Because when we get it wrong, I mean, not only do we deprive someone of their freedom and all of those opportunities, but the real perpetrator stays in our communities committing crime. So I think it says a lot about the power of racial ideologies and racism that we're not that concerned about getting it wrong.
Dr. Angela J. Hattery and Dr. Earl Smith have written a book entitled Policing Black Bodies. Today we focus on a conversation with Dr. Angela Hattery. Earl Smith will be joining us later on, not today, but at a later time. We are going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue with Dr. Angela J. Hattery. Thank you. I would just like to go back to the conversation we were having a moment ago about rape. We are in no way attempting to diminish or dismiss the horror of rape, the fact that white women are raped by black men, the fact that black women are raped by white men. But what we're looking at is the rate of wrongful convictions and exonerations. For years, Dr. Hattery, I did a great deal of work with rape victims. And unfortunately, I was never surprised when a black woman had been assaulted, had been raped, whether it was a black perpetrator or a white perpetrator. I was never surprised that he didn't get caught. And I was always not surprised when a white woman was assaulted and the alleged perpetrator did get caught. And that's just so not okay on so many levels.
It's 100% not okay. And as you mentioned, when you were reading off some of the books that I've written, one of the books is Intimate Partner Violence. I've been working on sexual and intimate partner violence issues like you for a very long time. It's never okay. 100% agree with you. And what I think exonerations really shine a light on, it's a little bit like the Wizard of Oz and you pull back the curtain. I think we argue they're so powerful in the book because they illustrate the way in which black bodies are valued. And so in addition to just talking about exonerations, we talk about just what you suggested, which is that black bodies, when they're the victims of the crime, have less value. Black bodies, when they're the perpetrator of the crime, have more value, right? In the sense of we need to get them, we need to catch them. And it's the exact opposite for white bodies, right? When white women are raped, for example, everyone pulls out all the stops to go find the perpetrator. When white men rape black women, I mean, that's been going on for centuries with no consequence, and that continues to be the case. And that's exactly the crux of what we argue creates these wrongful convictions, is when a white woman is raped and or murdered, and the suspect is a black man, you know, the police, although one would think you would get it right, the police really marshal all of their efforts to get somebody. And unfortunately, for hundreds of black men, it's the wrong somebody, right? And we argue that that's because getting one black man is more important than not getting one at all, right? And if you get it wrong, well, too bad. If the racial ideology is that black men will commit crime, then perhaps you prevented a future crime from happening. And we actually heard people in the community where we were living at the time and studying exoneration, we actually heard white people say that. They said, you know, well, he must have done something, or at least maybe you've prevented future crime when you have locked this person up. It's just, it's unbelievable. And as you said, all of it does a disjustice, a total disjustice to the victim.
And, you know, the fact is that the way that the laws are set up, the black body that is imprisoned is actually more cost effective, more cost beneficial for some members of the society than the black body who is not locked up and is out living his or her life. How can that be?
Well, that you just hit the, you know, you've hit the million-dollar question of it, that, you know, what we're trying to argue in the book and the case that we're trying to make is how did this happen? And it happened, as we were talking earlier, in the roots of chattel slavery. You know, we document in the book that when you look at incarceration, it has the effect of turning back many, many of the civil rights gains of the 1960s, 1950s, and 1960s. So if you think about slavery into Jim Crow, sharecropping and peonage and all these various ways of controlling black bodies, 1950s and 1960s disrupt that. And suddenly it's not legal in some cases. It's a little bit more ethically problematic or morally challenging to do what white people had done for centuries. And so there's a little bit of a pause, and in comes Richard Nixon. Who, as we, you know, discuss in the book, declares a war on drugs, which is really a thinly disguised war on Black bodies. And incarceration becomes the way to do all of the things, or most of the things, that slavery and Jim Crow had done for centuries, right? So one of the things, and Michelle Alexander argues this in her book as well, The New Jim Crow, that incarceration removes Black bodies from the political economy. They're just removed. They're cordoned off behind bars. What we argue and expand on her discussion is that prison industries allow for the continued exploitation, economic exploitation of those Black bodies, you know, by engaging in, you know, inmates, incarcerated people, in work, paying them a very, very minimal wage, and then selling all of the fruits of their labor, the products, for, you know, enormous profits in the marketplace. That's not any different than slavery or sharecropping.
When you say
people's labor being taken away.
When you say selling their products, what are you talking about?
We're talking about a whole lot of things. Many, many corporations do work with, you know, they send work into prisons, into prison factories. One of the ones that we highlight in the book is McDonald's, but many fast food restaurants, their uniforms are produced in prisons. Government agencies do an awful lot of work with prisoners. For example, in New York State, if you call the DMV because you need, you know, to do something with your driver's license or your license plate or whatever, that call center is in a women's prison. And so the people answering that phone call are inmates. And, you know, we don't in general have a problem. We're at all not critical of inmates working. We argue that, you know, it gives you something to do. People get out of the cell for a few hours, you know, a day. They might learn a few skills that they could use on the outside. What we have a problem with is that most of that work is being compensated at less than a dollar an hour. So somebody sewing the, you know, an inmate sewing the McDonald's uniform or answering the phone call for the New York State DMV might be making 30 or 40 or 50 cents an hour, right? And that means that the profit, of course, the profit margin is greater, or in the cost of the state of New York, the cost of running that is cheaper. We also are suggesting that there's people in the community, many of them Black, but also white people who might wanted that job for $8 or $9 an hour, right? So the DMV is now relocated to a prison. That means a whole bunch of people who could have done that job aren't being paid their wage. So it really has a pretty significant economic impact on Black communities.
So it would be interesting if folks were able to find out the list of corporations that farm their work out to prisons and then boycott those corporations. I wonder how many people would be imprisoned then.
I think that's a great question. And that's one of the things we suggest at the end of the book is, you know, not only do some research and figure out where your dollars are going, but a couple other things you might think about. In the last 20 years, we've had the rise of private prisons. So these are for-profit prisons, right? This is a situation where a state or the federal government can pay a private prison to house inmates. And they do it in a way that is much more cost effective. Mostly they pay their guards a lot less, and they have fewer, you know, there's fewer programs and stuff in those prisons. That's $1 billion a year profit industry that trades on the New York Stock Exchange. So you might want to look in your 401k investment and see if you're actually benefiting from incarceration. In private prisons, it's not just the labor. You're actually making money off locking somebody up. I think it would be very interesting if people started investigating their own 401k plans to see what, you know, are they benefiting from that?
Let's talk about a concept called colorblind racism. There are many people who say, I am not racist. I don't see color. This is not an issue of somebody's color. This is an issue of somebody's behavior, good behavior, bad behavior. Color has nothing to do with it. But you and your colleagues say that colorblind racism is a problem, and that being colorblind is an example of racism. Talk to me.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think at the basic level, to say that I don't see color or I don't see race is really offensive, because it implies that I don't see people as who they are and I don't see their history, right? So if I don't see Black people as Black, then I'm erasing those hundreds of years of chattel slavery and Jim Crow. I'm just erasing it and making it invisible. So first of all, I think it's really offensive. And as a woman, I would feel the same way if people said, oh, I don't see gender. Okay, you know, that's really offensive to me, because there's a lot of things about my gender that are important that impact my life. I make less money than my male colleagues. I'm at much higher risk for sexual violence, as you and I talked about earlier. So that would be a really offensive thing. But what we also really try to focus on in the book is to move it away from the individual level, that it's problematic when people say, I'm colorblind, I don't see race. But it's way more problematic when policies and procedures, as we argue, appear to be race neutral but are not. Because when they appear to be race neutral, then it lowers our defense mechanism. So we're not looking at the war on drugs or the treatment of pregnant Black bodies. We're not looking at that as racial if we think that it's not, because it's presented as not, when in fact it is. So the war on drugs is probably the simplest example of colorblind racism, but we talk about several other examples in the book. Most of us probably could agree, we could come to the table and agree that it's important to monitor drug use. People have different feelings about legal and illegal drugs. But we all can come around the table and I think agree that we need some control over drugs. Probably many of them need to be illegal and there needs to be accountability for drug use. Maybe we can all agree to that. But what's buried inside the war on drugs, or not buried so deeply, is the fact that it's applied racially. And probably the clearest example is the sentencing disparities around crack and powder cocaine. 5 grams of crack yields a mandatory minimum sentence of 5 years with no parole. A second offense, a possession offense of 5 grams, is 10 years. And with 3 possessions, you can be locked away for the rest of your life under the 3 strikes you're out or habitual felon law. It takes 100 times more cocaine possession to yield the same sentence. And it's pretty clear that that law was applied and put into place, that particular ratio, because Black people were using crack and white people were using cocaine. And cocaine was glamorized in the movies and crack was, you know, vilified in the news media. Again, a war on drugs appears to be race neutral, but it's not. And when we don't see the racial component to it, then we're less willing to interrogate it, ask questions about it, think about whether it's the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do. And in the book, we give an example of, you know, crack and powder cocaine are the only drugs that have this kind of disparity. So, you know, if someone's pulled over for a DUI or for underage drinking, they don't get a stiffer sentence if they were drinking vodka as opposed to 3-2 beer, right, or wine. So it's really an interesting example of a racialized law that appears to be race neutral.
You talk about, by way of an example, in West Baltimore, which of course is in Maryland, tensions created in the housing market. And you specifically reference the banking practice of Wells Fargo Bank, which is a very well-known bank. You say that they contributed to the underlying tensions and frustrations, particularly among Black persons. How did they do that?
So that's a great question, and that's another great example of a colorblind racist policy. So if we can use that as a segue as well. So it would be more than reasonable that a bank is going to loan you money based on your credit rating, right? And we could all agree to that, that the bank, we don't want banks loaning money to people that can't pay the money back. That makes sense. What Wells Fargo was doing was taking Black and white applicants for mortgages and giving, and when the, so, you know, two people show up, to Wells Fargo, and they have the same credit score, the same history, the same kind of employment. One is black and one is white. Wells Fargo gives a reasonable loan to the white person, maybe 3-4% to buy a house. But to the black person, they give one of these toxic predatory mortgages. Maybe the interest rate is 19% or 20%, or maybe it's an ARM loan where it's a low interest rate for the first few years and then it blows up 5 years in. This was happening. And Wells Fargo actually had, you know, was sued and had to pay, they were forced to pay fines and fees because this was a systematic predatory lending practice that was happening in West Baltimore. I think the practice alone is a form of policing. And people, to the degree that they were talking, probably began to figure out that in the black community, they were getting unfair treatment. They were not getting the same access to a mortgage that people in the white community were getting. And then comes the housing bubble and the collapse. And this happened in Baltimore, was hit pretty severely. It happened in Prince George's County, Maryland, lots of other places around the United States where the value of the homes, because you began to have these ARM mortgages, people couldn't pay and there were foreclosures at very high rates. You know, all of the property in those neighborhoods loses value in that situation. I think it's pretty fair to assume that people were mad and that we can trace that as one of the factors that contributes to, you know, unrest and dissatisfaction in West Baltimore. It's sort of like getting kicked when you're down and then continuing to get kicked. And most of those communities have not recovered. So when Freddie Gray is murdered, it's sort of like the fire hose in the 1960s. All of a sudden, people said, you know what, I'm tired of this. Or we can think of Rosa Parks. I'm not going to get up. I'm tired. I'm not doing it. She wasn't the first black woman to, you know, sit on the bus or the first black person. She was in a long line of sort of, I can't take it anymore. And that's what we're arguing in the book, is that when the riots erupt after Freddie Gray is murdered, it's not just Freddie Gray, although his life is certainly of worth, but it's long, 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 decades long tensions between the black community and social institutions like banks and the police and other organizations.
You know, one of the questions that we will begin to take a look at later on in our conversation today is, when does this all end? I mean, and again, the more you talk about the findings of you and your colleague, the more you talk about the information that is shared in policing black bodies, sort of the heavier and heavier it gets. And I know we've said this before in today's conversation, but in fact, it becomes so heavy that, you know, there are people who just don't want to deal with it anymore. It's like enough already.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we get that. And I think I'm teaching a class right now using the book, and that's the title of the class. And my students are tired. And I can see that they're tired. And for many of the white students, they're tired because this is new and it hurts. And they have to look inward and think about their own behavior. For many of the black students, it's exhausting because it rings close to home. It reminds them of people in their families or their own experiences. And it's exhausting. And we've had to pause and talk about that. And we get it. You probably don't want to read the book. You know, you certainly, it's not a beach book, probably not something you want to take on vacation and not something that you want to read all at once. But we think it's an important book, and that the conversations can't move forward until white people in particular are willing to do the hard work of reading a book like this, beginning the conversations, holding themselves accountable for the ways in which they're benefiting, frankly, from the policing of black bodies. We do offer at the end of the book some suggestions for things you can do tomorrow. So when you're feeling overwhelmed, there are some things, and you and I talked about one of those already. That's look at the products that you're buying and think about whether you're contributing to prison industries. But we make a number of other recommendations for things that people can do, hoping that, you know, leads to action and not the sort of immobility that can sometimes come from dealing with these kinds of questions.
Professor Hattery, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue discussing the policing of black bodies, how black lives are surveilled, and how to work for change. We'll be right back. Professor Hattery, we've been talking about the ways, obviously, ways in which race has been used to harm people. But we've also referenced the way in which race has been used to benefit other people, more specifically, white people. So if I'm a white person and I'm benefiting from all this stuff, why do I want to change anything?
That's a great question, and that's really obviously one of the hardest parts of this argument, right, is convincing white people when they are benefiting from these systems why they would be interested in giving away some of their power and some of their privilege. I asked my students in class early on, the white students, you know, are you willing? What are you willing to give? What are you willing to give up? Are you willing to give up the fact that, you know, you have a better chance of getting admitted to college or a better chance of getting a job, or you're going to make more money, or you're less likely to be incarcerated? And that's really the question that we are asking people. For us, we're certainly not the first people to say it. It comes from a long line of Black feminists like Audre Lorde and bell hooks and others. Ultimately, we all pay a price when our society is this stratified and there's this much inequality. And that's really how we close the book is, you know, things aren't getting better with regards to race. I mean, we have little gains here and there, but for the most part, we look at the numbers and, you know, inequality is growing. It's not decreasing. And that's also the case for poor whites, right? They're also not benefiting from this system in the same way that maybe they used to. Where's it going to end? You know, most countries that we look at around the world, higher levels of inequality always mean higher rates of crime, higher rates of disease, higher rates of all sorts of stuff that none of us benefit from. Societies that have less inequality, everyone has more education, the economy is better for everybody, everybody's healthier. So we sort of make a call to that sort of moral imperative that if we don't fix this, I think we're pretty clear. We think our country eventually will disintegrate. I mean, we cannot, not literally disintegrate, but, you know, we can't continue this. The tensions are too great. Too many people's lives are lost for the gain of a few. And if we can't get this right, if we can't fix it, what hope does any of us have really of surviving?
You talk about a time when white men actually outnumbered Black men by 2-1 in jails and prisons. And now, on any given day, you're saying that at least 1 million Black men are imprisoned. 1 million Black men are imprisoned in the United States. What happened?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I'm glad that you raised that, because a lot of people don't understand that reality. They think that it's always been this way. So sort of why are Black people complaining about being policed? They've always been more likely to be in prison. And as you point out, up until about 1970, white men were proportionately incarcerated, as were Black men. So the racial gap was much closer to the reality of the presence of those two groups in the country, right? What happened was the war on drugs. And, you know, it's always interesting what happens when you're working on a project like this in the middle of writing the book. John Ehrlichman, who was, I believe, chief of staff to Richard Nixon, then got caught up in Watergate and spent some time in prison, was interviewed in the spring of 2016 about the war on drugs. And we have the quote in the book. Folks can read it. You can find it on the internet. John Ehrlichman says flat out, Richard Nixon had a problem with the Vietnam War and he had a problem with Black people. And he knew, I'm paraphrasing, but he knew it wouldn't be, he couldn't have a war against the hippies or Black people. That wouldn't be okay. So instead he invents a war on drugs. And he criminalizes marijuana and he criminalizes heroin and crack cocaine and, you know, arrests people, pulls them out of their houses, takes their leaders, locks them up in prison, and reinforces in the media that Black people and hippies in this case were thugs. So he's pretty clear. You know, the person interviewing Ehrlichman asks him the question, and Ehrlichman says, Did we know we were lying about the drugs? You bet we did, right? It was a war on Black people. And that's the moment where we begin to see this absolute switch in incarceration. So that literally Black men make up 6% of the U.S. population and 50% of the incarcerated population. It's absurd, right?
Can you
it's absolutely absurd.
Can you repeat those statistics for us again?
Sure. So Black men make up about 6% of the U.S. population and about 50% of the incarcerated population.
That's
a deep number.
That's a huge number.
Yeah.
Right, but let me ask you another question. We have had a Black president. So are we not now living in a country where race doesn't matter? Isn't the policing of Black bodies no longer a problem? We had a Black president, and we had him two terms in a row. Aren't we done with race?
Yeah, that's such a wonderful thing to think, isn't it? And I think especially a lot of white people would love to say, wow, we are in a post-racial society. We don't have to talk about this anymore. We don't have to do anything about this anymore. And, you know, actually, Dr. Smith and I wrote another book called African American Families, Myths and Realities. It was published first, I believe, in 2010 and again in 2014. And we exactly examine your question, which is what's been the impact of the Obama presidency on the Black community? And I think the impact has been emotionally very positive. You know, it's fantastic to see a Black person occupying the White House. But in terms of addressing incarceration or housing, gaps in education, none of those things have really gotten any better, largely because, not because Obama, I believe 100% that Obama cared about all of those things. So not because he didn't care, but because he's struggling with the Congress that's still way disproportionately white, right? And is not interested in kind of practices or policies that would close those racial gaps. They're more interested in policies that, as I mentioned earlier, appear to be race neutral, but are not. The opioid epidemic is a great example of that. Poor women, white women who are addicted to opioids and pregnant, there's all these measures and moves to get them into rehab, which is fantastic because moms and babies have better outcomes when women get off drugs while they're pregnant. But Black women who are addicted to crack go to prison. And that's not good for them or for the babies that they're carrying. So as wonderful as, you know, Obama's, how wonderful it feels to have elected Obama and have him elected twice and serve in office, you know, the numbers just don't match up. In many ways, the Black community, because of the housing bubble and foreclosures and other things, probably fell farther behind.
You indicate that since 1980, the number of women in prison has risen by 700%. I got to tell you, the statistics that you give in policing Black bodies are pretty scary. But be that as it may, they're accurate. The number of women in prison has risen by 700%. How does that impact Black women?
Well, I mean, disproportionately, like everything else, right? So as we argue in the book, even though women still only make up about 10% of the prison population, the fact that we're incarcerating more and more of them, and especially more and more Black women, is devastating consequences, not just for those women, but for their families. A million children today have a mom in prison. 5 million children, disproportionately Black, have a parent in prison. 6% of women entering prison, and that's disproportionately Black women, have a child while they're incarcerated. Often they lose custody of that child. And what's most important, I think, to point out is that this is not because women are committing more violent crime or the kinds of crimes that we would be concerned about. This is mostly low-level drug charges, low-level financial crimes like writing bad checks, and that sort of thing. They're the crimes of people who are in poverty and the crimes of people who have no other way to take care of their families or really to, you know, ease the pain. It's really important to point out that among women who are in prison, incarcerated, and this is, you know, disproportionately Black women, 85% of them experienced sexual or intimate partner violence before they were incarcerated. 70% of them have mental illness. So we're locking up people that need intervention, not a prison sentence.
What is the impact of having a criminal conviction on one's record in the Black community?
It's devastating. And that's part of what we talk about in the book. Because not a lot of people think about the impact of a conviction for an entire community. So if we think about one third of Black men will go to prison in their lifetime, but that doesn't cut across all, you know, socioeconomic categories equally. Poor Black men, probably 7 out of 10 will go to prison in their lifetimes. They come back to a community with a felony conviction, and now they can't vote, for one thing. So you have entire communities, West Baltimore would be a great example, where you have an entire community that can't elect its school board members or can't elect, forget about the president, they can't elect the people locally who will, you know, make decisions about policing practices or the school to prison pipeline. It's really important. We were giving a talk yesterday with some high school kids. It's really important to note that a drug felony conviction means you're ineligible forever for a student loan. That's not true for rapists or murderers or child molesters or any other crime, but drug felonies bar you from ever getting a student loan. They bar you from living in public housing. They bar you from getting any sort of welfare. They bar you from getting a job most of the time. So the impact on the Black community is, it's just impossible to quantify. It's enormous. It's deep and very wide-reaching.
Have you looked at the impact of plea bargaining for persons in the Black community, for Black people?
We haven't looked specifically at it, but I was actually reading a study earlier this week that was looking at the sentencing of Black and white defendants in sexual assault cases. And that study found that white men were far more likely to be given a reasonable plea bargain so that they end up getting a conviction, but or sometimes lesser charges. But that data in that particular example definitely suggested that white people are benefiting more from the system of plea bargaining than Black people are in that study in particular.
And in the instance of having a felony conviction, can you ever do anything about that? Is your life forever negatively impacted upon by that conviction?
That's really the depressing question, right? One would hope not, but the reality is that because you become ineligible for all of these safety net programs, student loans, but also, you know, so that has a huge impact. But also we cite the work of a sociologist named Diva Pager, who did a really neat experiment where she sent out a Black tester and a white tester, one with a felony, one without a felony, in each category. They're real people, but not real job applicants. And she looked at the rates of callback that the applicants got for a job. And what she found was not surprising, that white men without a felony record were called back the most often, and Black men with a felony record were called back the least often, at only 3%. But what was really stunning about her finding is she found that white men with a felony were called back more often than Black men without a felony. And I'm going to say that again. White men with a felony received more job callbacks than Black men without a felony. So it seems, you know, the data are really clear that once you've got that felony, unless someone's willing to take a chance on you, it's going to be a hard row. You know, it's hard. And most Black men and women who go to prison are poor to start with. So they go in poor, they come home poorer, and with fewer opportunities, to make a living or get an education. It's tough.
And when you come out of prison, you're supposed to get a job and integrate into the community and be a law-abiding citizen. But what you're saying is that that's really hard to do if you can't get a job and if you can't find any services to help you.
Exactly. It's exactly. And that's a large part of that fuels, actually, the system of mass incarceration. About 70% of people who come out of prison go back. And most of them go back not for committing another crime, but for violating some aspect of their parole or probation. And often that's an inability to pay a fine or a fee. It might be an inability to pay for a service that they need, like a treatment program, or the inability to get a job. It's a revolving door that is just really harsh and really devastating. And what's interesting is there, you know, before the war on drugs, before we started disproportionately incarcerating Black people, people did used to be able to come out and have a second chance, but it's pretty hard to see many examples of that anymore. So we argue, you know, Black bodies are policed right into the criminal justice system, and then they continue to be policed, you know, every day after that.
The policing of Black bodies, what can we do in the few minutes that we have left? You've mentioned some of the things that we can do and why we should do them. Are there any other options you would like to briefly indicate?
Sure. I'd love to give a couple of examples. Following up on this conversation, people might know about felons have to check a box. If you have a felony conviction, you have to check a box on a job application. There's a movement to, it's called Ban the Box. There's a movement to get rid of that. And a lot of the data from folks coming back from prison indicate that when they get a chance at a job, when someone gives them a chance and they do a good job, even though they have a felony, the employers retain them. So one of the suggestions we have is give a felon a chance. You can still do a background check. You can still do all the things you need to do to keep yourself safe. But if you have a job, consider hiring someone that's been to prison. Especially when it comes around to elections, you know, if you're interested in voting and democracy, go register someone, you know, help someone who's been disenfranchised, help them get their voting rights back. It's not easy, but it's legal. Give them a chance to help make a difference, you know, elect the people in their own community. Volunteer, as you know, you've done work with rape victims, volunteer, you know, in a school, volunteer with mental health issues, volunteer with kids who have, you know, experienced violence, and try to interrupt the cycle so that they don't end up following their parents, you know, to prison. There's just a ton of things that people can actually do that make a difference in individual lives and hopefully in larger communities.
Well, I'm pleased to say that we are ending this conversation with things that you actually can do to make a positive difference. Angela J. Hattery, co-author with Earl Smith of Policing Black Bodies, How Black Lives Are Surveilled, and How to Work for Change. Is there a website for the book?
Yeah, you can get in touch with us at the website. It's www.smithandhattery.com. That's www.smithandhattery.com.
Terrific. Thank you very much for spending time with us today. And again, folks who are listening, we will have part two of this conversation at a later date. So be sure to continue to tune in to Mind Talk. Dr. Hattery, thank you.
Thank you.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. As you've heard me indicate, this is part one of a two-part conversation, Policing Black Bodies. If you are not currently on the Mind Talk mailing list, just send your email to me, Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. mindtalk.org, and you will receive weekly program guides so that you will know when part two is about to be aired. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. I would love to hear from you about where you are in the world as you're listening to Mind Talk, and certainly any thoughts that you may have or reactions that you may have to today's conversation. So again, that email address for me is Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. You can listen to Mind Talk by going to the Mind Talk website, by downloading the free Mind Talk apps. There are lots of places to go where you can hear this program. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, then that's what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.